Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us tonight at Free Library at Home. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Before we begin tonight's presentation, I wanted to point out a couple of useful features on your screen. You'll see there's a button below that suggests that you buy a copy of our guest's new book, Being Human. The button links to the website of the Joseph Fox Bookshop, our bookseller for more than 20 years. They will be happy to send a copy of the book to you anywhere in the country. On screen, you'll also see the Ask a Question link, which you can use to ask a question, suggest a topic, or upvote a question by using the arrows in the left margin. It's now my honor to introduce our guests. A leader in the disability rights and independent living movement, renowned the world over and now featured in the new film, Crip Camp, Judith Heumann has spent more than four decades working with a wide array of government agencies, activist groups, and NGOs on legislation and policy that benefits disabled as well as non-disabled people. Praised by Hillary Clinton for her insights, knowledge, sass, and wit, Heumann served in Bill Clinton's administration, shaping disability policy in the Department of Education, and was appointed by Barack Obama as the Special Advisor on Disability Rights for the State Department. She is also a former senior fellow at the Ford Foundation and advisor to the World Bank. She joins us tonight to discuss her life, work, and new book, Being Human, an unrepentant memoir of a disability rights activist. She'll be in conversation with our very good friend, Tamela Edwards, anchor of 6ABC Action News Morning Edition. Judy and Tam, the screen is yours.
Thank you, Mary.
All right. That's wonderful. Andy, in this new age of social distancing, it's great to see that we can still get it done. And Judy, it was an honor truly to read your book. It is a running theme in the book, how often people tell you, people who should know, say, I had no idea. And I'm hopeful that people reading your book and joining in on the conversation tonight will be brought up to speed on what your fight has been about and all the changes that you have made. And in fact, that's where I wanted to start, to give people a little bit of a perspective. I wanted you to do a compare and contrast what it was like when you were a young person. You opened the book talking about your childhood in Brooklyn, what it was like to be a person coming into the world then with a disability, and what it's like now, the differences that you see.
Well, on the one hand, the differences are very, very significant. Because when I had polio in 1949 in Brooklyn, there was just the beginning of television. And I think we really need to recognize the important role that television has played, and we can get into discussing that as we go forward. There were no laws that protected the rights of disabled people. There really weren't many laws that were protecting the rights of other minority groups. So at that point, disabled people not being protected wasn't as unusual. But people were really very much looking at disability as a medical issue and looking at the issue of curing disability. So there really wasn't a lot of activity going on to look at discrimination as a component of what was happening to disabled people. And so over the beginning of my life, my parents were both German Jewish refugees. Mm-hmm. They came over in the 30s. They met in the 40s after my father left the Marines at the end of the war. And they lost their parents, grandmother on either side, and other relatives. So when they got married, they were looking to set up a family. Okay. And I was born. Then my mother was pregnant with my brother. And when I had polio in 1949, she was 8 months pregnant. Mm. And my father had just started opening up a butcher store with his brother. So everything was kind of thrown up in the air. And I think, you know, to my parents' credit, while they didn't know any other families who had disabled children, they had no idea what was about to happen, separate from, you know, my having had polio. But they really decided they were going to have me live my life like they wanted me to prior to my birth, without having a disability. So my mother took me to school. I was denied the right to go to school because I couldn't walk, and the principal said I was a fire hazard. Didn't actually finally get to go to school until I was 9 years old, and then it was segregated classes. In between the first to the fourth grade, I only had a teacher who came two times a week for a total of 2.5 hours a week. So today we have laws on the books that make what happened to me then illegal. So in 1975, there was an important law that came out in the area of education. In 1973, there was something called Section 504. I really encourage people to look at this film, Crip Camp, C-R-I-P-C-A-M-P on Netflix. It gives you additional information. Life today is different in many ways. I would say specifically because of all the anti-discrimination laws and affirmative action laws, disabled people have more opportunities than they did, for sure, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But when looking at discrimination against any group, when we've lived in societies that have discriminated against people based on their religion, on their race, on their disability, it doesn't change that rapidly. And so I think what's been happening is the disability community has been organizing more. We've been becoming empowered amongst ourselves. We've been reaching out into the general society, basically saying, we want to be able to be equal members in the community. So there is a movement of disabled people, which did not exist at that time. And the movement itself is moving away from the medical model and really looking at the social justice and rights-based model.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I read your book. I also watched Crip Camp on Netflix. And it talks about a place that you mentioned in the book, Camp Jeanette, which it was the first place where, honestly, you just got to be a person. You just got to be a kid. You weren't defined by ability or disability. And there's a moment when all of the kids are talking and the things that they say that they want are just so basic and normal for everyday teenagers and everyday humans. And it really hit me when one person said, I just would like my privacy. Like everybody's had a teenager say, get out of my room. I want my privacy. That they want the ability to be bad, the ability to have a boyfriend, girlfriend, to be seen sexually, to exist in the world. And it made me really think about how we look at people with disabilities, whether they are physical, mental, emotional, or otherwise. We're very quick to almost try to turn them into children, to flatten them, to make them simplistic in a way. And it sort of reminded me or taught me, just like everybody else, there is a really rich interior life. There's a person who wants to be heard and deserves to be heard. And I would imagine, I mean, that's at the heart of your argument. We're no different than you are.
Right. And I think you shaped it very well. And for me, I think some of the issues are that it is frequently difficult for disabled people to really talk about that part of themselves. We typically grow up in families where we're the only disabled person, as opposed to families of a particular race or gender. You know, you have a mother, a grandmother, an aunt, an uncle, friends. In the area of disability, I didn't know any disabled people until I started going to segregated classes when I was 9 years old. And then when I went to Camp Oakhurst and then to Camp Jeanette, those were times where both school and these other experiences where I could speak about the whole of myself. So I could talk about what I was beginning to feel as I got older and could articulate things in a way that, you know, children can't. You know, why couldn't I get on a bus? Why didn't people have the same expectations? Why did people stare at me? Whatever it might have been. And equally important, I didn't hear people talking to me or my friends about a future. So as you grow older, and certainly in today's society, people are talking about, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? People didn't really talk to me and my friends. What did we want to be when we grew up? But we did want to be something when we grew up. And so those are some of the discussions that we would have. And, you know, the comment that you made about treating disabled people as children, that I think is a very powerful statement, because for me, even today, when we were able to go out, it would not be uncommon. I go to an airport and I'm going to go give a speech, you know, in another part of the country or the world or whatever. And people don't talk to me. They talk to the people that I'm with who are there to assist me. They'll say, what does she want? Like that happens all the time. And I would say, in getting back to the earlier question about how are things different, things are very different and they're very the same. Because the absence of disability in television, in advertising, in journalism, you know, media broadly, continues to marginalize us. And you also were referring to the breadth of who we are as disabled people. And I think that's a very important issue. It's not just those of us with visible disabilities. It's those of us with depression or anxiety or bipolar or diabetes or cancer or epilepsy or any one of a number of hundreds of disabilities. And I think, you know, what we still find, although it's improving, is that many disabled people do not want to identify, even if they have a visible disability, because of the stigma, because of how they're treated. They don't necessarily want to hang out with other disabled people. But as we are doing more together, we're learning both about the commonality of experiences and the differences of experiences. So now, you know, with the pandemic, one of the big issues that's being discussed has to do with African Americans and Latinos who are dying at higher rates. And they talk about underlying conditions, which are diabetes, hypertension, obesity. All of these are disabilities. And so people are, in some cases, at greater risk. And in many cases, they're not getting the services that they need along the way because they're poor or other reasons. But I do hope that one of the outcomes of this tragedy is that we really are able to have more in-depth discussions about why it is so important that our disability community, which according to the federal government in the US, numbers 56 million people.
Wow.
And according to the World Health Organization and the World Bank, at least 15% of the population of the world, 1 billion people, have disabilities. So, you know, my book is really trying to do a combination of things. One is reflect me as I was growing up and how I experienced life as things move forward. But also, I hope, like with Crip Camp, to really get people to start thinking more about, do they have a disability, that maybe they know they have a disability, but they don't know how to discuss it? Do they have people in their families or friends? And what kind of a dialogue do we really need to be having to ensure that disability across our communities is something which we're intent on learning more about and looking at what we can do to really help break down the barriers and look at what discrimination is and what role we're playing in fostering that.
You know, it's interesting because part of what people know is what's in the culture. It's what's talked about. It's what's taught. As an African-American, the civil rights movement is clearly something I grew up learning about, and not just in the family, but in popular culture, in school. And when you think about other movements, the gay rights movement, the women's movement, these are stories that even if you're not paying attention, even if you don't care, you know the basic pinpoints of what has happened here. And you point out in the book that as Crip Camp came out or other documentaries, that people who you thought should be in the know would say to you, I had no idea. And honestly, Judy, till I read your book, I had no idea. Your fight was not a fight that lasted for weeks or for months. You lay out fights that lasted for decades. That being the case, why are we not aware of the fight around disability rights and civil rights the same way we are those other movements?
Why do you think?
I don't know. I mean, there's the decision, obviously, not to teach it in schools. There's the decision not to talk about it as much. And it feels as though, for whatever reason, people do not put people in the disability group in that same protected class or concerned class You know, Hulu has something on right now about Mrs. America. They're going back through Phyllis Schlafly and the fight over the ERA. I can't think of the last time that I've seen on major television a story about disability rights. And you actually point out when we do see the disabled, they're the villain or they're the tragic anti-hero. They're never the romantic lead. They're never the best person in the movie.
Or if they are, they don't have a disability.
Right.
Like 10 years ago, Coming Home with John Voight, I'm dating myself, I'm 72, this was in the 70s. You know, he was a positive character playing a paraplegic. However, he doesn't really have a disability. And My Left Foot, all these movies where there are positive messages, Forrest Gump, you know, they're played by non-disabled people. That's another whole issue. I think that one of the basic issues around why not, why are we not seeing more, is a combination. One is, I think people are afraid of acquiring a disability themselves. They look at people like myself or whomever, and they say, I don't know how they do it. I couldn't do it. They don't really know what it is, and they don't really know not only what it is that we are doing, but they don't really also think about themselves and their futures. And the reason I say that, and this is a little bit of the discussion that I had when I was doing the Trevor Noah show, is when he used the word able-bodied. And I said, no, I don't use the word able-bodied because I use the word non-disabled. And I use it for a couple of reasons. I don't like using the word able because it implies that I'm not able. And I don't want to have to use the word to tell somebody that I have abilities because that should be something that they understand. So I think like with the terminology of people using like the able disabled or whatever it may be, it is maybe not intentional, but I think it's the term that we use, like racist is ableist. So I think that's an issue. I also think, as you were discussing, not seeing and learning about disability and the way disabled people are characterized, and infrequently, even when we are characterized, I think that also leaves people who have questions afraid of asking them. So things have gotten a little better in the following way. Going down the street, I use a motorized wheelchair. So children will frequently be curious, right? They haven't seen one. And so in some cases, they want to ask a question. And we used to call it the potato chip issue. So a child wanted to ask you a question, the parents would pull the child away, distract them, so they didn't ask the question. For me, and this is not true of everybody, some people do not like to be asked, what's your disability? For me, I really don't mind if somebody asks. And for children, I really want to engage them. First of all, when I'm going down the street and there are kids in a baby carriage, we're more on the same eye level. I am definitely drawn to them because I watch their eyes and they look at my wheels. And little boys look at the wheels all the time. Little girls, not so much. But talking to them and getting the parents engaged, some of the parents are like totally there. They're kind of cool about it and they'll kneel down and we'll discuss the wheelchair and point out where the batteries are and where the chair gets plugged in and all these others. And again, others are just like, please stop embarrassing me. Don't ask any more questions. You can just see it. But I think the absence means people have logical questions. You know, we're not the majority of people in society, whether we're blind or deaf or hard of hearing, or have a physical disability or an invisible disability. People need to understand. Children and adults need to understand. And I think really one of the biggest issues is people don't see themselves acquiring a disability. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people break limbs all the time and it's a temporary disability. But as people get older, their sight, their hearing, their ability to communicate, their ability to ambulate as independently as before. They may have other kinds of memory issues. And we tend to look at marginalizing people. I mean, if you look at what's going on right now with the pandemic, both in the US and around the world, some of the highest areas of death as a result of people acquiring the virus are in these institutions. And the question is, why are people in the institutions? People are in the institutions for home, because their homes are not accessible. People buy homes that are not accessible. They don't want to buy homes that are accessible. We don't look at the need for personal assistance. Like I can't go to bed myself. I can't get up. I can't get dressed. I can't go to the bathroom. I can't do all these things. But when I'm able to have someone who can help me, I can do all those things. So if people become invested in their futures, not even in my future, but in your own future, what do you need to be preparing for in the event that these various things happen? Not in a negative way, but in a positive way. What does one need to do in order to stay in their community? And really be willing to look at some of the more difficult questions so that you're in charge. I think that's really important. As long as you can be in charge or you have systems set up where other people that you know and respect can be helping, I think those are many of the issues. But I think ultimately, people don't want to think about it. People are really afraid. And I think
go into it. You know, another thing, Judy, that stood out to me that I didn't learn until watching Crip Camp, you talk about a little bit in the book, your parents being told you should put her into an institution. And they said, absolutely not. You know, we fled a place where people were being put into an institution. And that's not what we're doing with our daughter. But in Crip Camp, there's a moment when Geraldo Rivera goes to a place called Willowbrook. And I don't think I've ever seen anything more upsetting and dehumanizing. Barely any workers, disabled children, left naked, covered in their own feces, not being allowed to eat, no time to feed them, just sort of storehoused. And it looked like something that Charles Dickens could not have imagined. And the fact that this existed in the last century and that it was allowed was shocking to me.
So in Pennsylvania, there was an institution called Penthurst. And I believe it was in the Philadelphia area. And it was very equivalent to Willowbrook. These types of institutions, while they're closing, and most of those big institutions are closed, one of the things you can also see happening now is people that are living in the nursing homes and other congregate living programs, some of them are quite large, not as large as Willowbrook, you know, not in the thousands, but 20, 30, 40, 50 people. And not only are those programs bad for the individual person, but they're bad for the community because they continue to perpetuate this image that disabled people need to be out of sight, out of mind. And then people are not, they're not treated as people, as individuals. And now during the pandemic, as I said earlier, we're looking at this issue of higher rates of death, both among the people living in these facilities and among the workers. Mm-hmm. Because the workers are also not treated appropriately. I mean, the right model is people need to be able to either live in their own home that they were in, or they need to be able to live in apartments and other places with, you know, one or two people. And it shouldn't be these larger congregate living programs, which are really bad models. I visited Willowbrook after Geraldo Rivera had been given the keys by two of the doctors at Willowbrook. And I went with a nun and a reporter. And when we got there, a friend of mine was one of the doctors who had broken open the story. And when we got there to, you know, get a pass, they were not going to let me in. They wanted me to sign a paper that if I got injured, I would not sue them. And of course, I would not sign any kind of a paper like that. And it was a horrifying experience. And when I worked for the State Department, I was in Mexico, and I got some of the employees of the State Department to come and visit an institution with me in Mexico City, because there's an organization called Disability Rights International, and they do work around the world on issues affecting people with mental health and psychosocial and intellectual disabilities. And they've been doing reporting on conditions in Mexico and many other countries. It was the first time that staff from the State Department had ever gone and visited an institution like this. And when we drove to the institution, the smell of urine was so overpowering, even before we got onto the grounds. And while people were not laying around naked like in Willowbrook, there were one or two people who were. There was no activity going on. And you had, you know, many, many people living there. So these models still exist in other countries, and people are afraid in this country that because of what's going on right now, instead of looking at moving people into the community more for expeditious reasons, they may be looking at putting people in more restricted environments, which of course the community will really fight against.
In the book, what I took away from it on so many levels, through so many of the stories you tell, that people should understand is that being disabled is exhausting, not because of the disability, but because of other people. The unnecessary hardships that they bring to it. You talk about going through a medical review with a doctor who was completely off point and trying to understand if you were a teacher, or you're going to get on a plane and they won't let you on the plane, or a million times over you have the conversation as you try to advocate for other people or participate in programs. Well, we're afraid something will happen to them. And you're like, well, aren't you afraid something's going to happen to everybody? They'll be fine. But you have to almost gird yourself for battle every day.
But don't you find, Tamala, that if you go back yourself or listen to your family, grandparents' stories, that this issue of guarding yourself, it may be, or girding yourself, it may be different types of scenarios, but really, you know, as a woman, as a Black woman,
yeah.
So it's something that you really want to go away. And I think, you know, your story, like my story, things have gotten better. But things will just pop up and hit you in the face. And you didn't expect it. And you don't know how to answer it. And for me, you know, you're in different situations. And by that, I mean, sometimes it's okay, I'm gonna completely come back and, you know, tear you up. But in other situations, you're really needing to measure how you say, what you say, who you say it to. So I think what gets challenging and makes me angry and sad is how much it still happens. So if you get to see the film Crip Camp, there, I kind of cry a lot when, and I think sometimes I go to cry when I'm angry. And I heard a friend of mine the other day, who doesn't have a disability, woman, who also said the same thing, having nothing to do with this disability, but how sometimes when she's really angry, she goes to cry. So there's two places in the movie. One, a group of 150 people had taken over a federal building in San Francisco because a set of regulations on a law called Section 504 prohibiting discrimination against disabled people in programs that got money from the federal government, comparable to a portion of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We'd been in the building. It was really exhausting, but people were really fighting hard to get these regulations signed. Two congressmen came to the building to hold hearings, and they had a representative from the Health, Education, and Welfare office come under the Carter administration. And the gentleman sat in the front, and I was testifying, and he kept shaking his head. And there's something about what happened while he was doing that where I completely lost it. I was giving my talk, and then at the end I said, I wish you would stop shaking your head like you understand what I'm saying, because you don't. And then I didn't cry, but I was like teary. And the audience applauded. And we've shown, when I worked at the State Department, a film called Lives Worth Living, and we showed it all over the world. That particular part, people applaud all the time. And the reason why I think they applaud is not because of what I did, but because what I did is what they want to do. The number of times when we confront where people are saying or doing something, oh, we understand and we don't mean it and whatever it may be, or we do understand and get out of here, whatever it may be, you know, your skin, your race, your orientation, whatever it is, that's what people need to really understand, not just about disability, but in my view, about discrimination overall. Discrimination hurts. Discrimination can result in death. Discrimination can result in non-equal treatment, lack of education, lack of employment opportunities, income, on and on. But we all need to have a better understanding of what, as a society, our vision is. And so for me, one of the parts of the book that was important was trying to really remember how I felt in these different incidences, to try to make them as real as possible. And one of the things that I hear from disabled people around the world is how reading the book is their story. And that is very powerful. And like comments that you were making about the book, then many other people who don't have disabilities saying, we didn't know this story. And I think the question of why, you know, and why didn't we know this story? I think it's because people really haven't wanted to. I think what's great about Crip Camp and the book is that if you're willing to take the time to read the book, if you're willing to take time to watch the movie, you get a better understanding. But of course, reading the book and watching the film is not going to change the world. So it's reading other people's books. You know, there are more people who have disabilities who are writing books. There's a great woman named Kia Brown. She's a 28-year-old Black lesbian, a woman with cerebral palsy in upstate New York. She's funny. She's smart. She's written a great book that's out. And other people like that. And so, you know, reading and saying to our local television stations and producers of movies, why are we not seeing more? Why are we not seeing disability with people from all different backgrounds?
It's an important question. At the end of the book, you talk about where we are now, because you go through so many administrations. It takes, I think, 3 or 4 presidents before 504 finally makes its way through. And then you talk about where we are today. Do you find yourself, after all these years of being in the fight, hopeful that the things you fought for will remain, fearful that they will be stripped away? You know, they often say that we exist on a pendulum. Things go back and forth. Do you feel as though we will swing back towards protecting these rights, or are you afraid that we're swinging away from doing anything for them?
I think our movement has really gotten stronger. And obviously, when the book was written and went to print, none of the situation that we're living in had occurred yet. And I am very afraid about the lasting impact of the pandemic, not just in the area of disability, but across the board. And what I know our community is going to be fighting for is making sure that laws which protect our rights and which protect the rights of others. I think that's one very important part of the changes that have occurred over the years, that the Leadership Conference for Civil Rights, for example, which is a very broad national organization, includes disability and disabled organizations in their work. There's an organization called the International Disability Alliance, which is fighting on an international level. There's an important convention that came out of the United Nations, called the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which was modeled after the Americans with Disabilities Act and has been ratified in 176 or 77 countries. That, that particular treaty and the Americans with Disabilities Act and others, we must fight for, like all the other civil rights acts, we must not allow government to push back against these protections. And I think that our community is more at the table than it was in the past. So we are right now playing an important role. Senator Casey's office, for example, he's doing an amazing job and has been his entire time in office, really fighting for the rights of disabled individuals, including people with intellectual and developmental and mental health disabilities. So he is, you know, from my perspective, a champion that is making sure that the voices of disabled people are engaged all the time. We're having weekly telephone calls to brief people, to engage people. So while I am concerned very much for the country and the world, I do believe that we have a better ability to fight against the kinds of changes that some people may want. And I'm really hoping in the fall with the elections that we can make some changes so that we have to be less fearful because we're not represented by someone who is respectful to us.
You know, you, as I was watching Crip Camp and they show pictures of you being a teenage girl sitting there with your friends, and now we can see the arc of what you went on to do with your life. Do you ever, you know, you always wonder when somebody steps into a moment, when a Rosa Parks or a Martin Luther King or Gloria Steinem or somebody out of all the people in the world chose to step into that moment. And you truly have been that person when it comes to disability rights. What do you think it was about Judy Heumann that made you the person who was at the forefront of so many of these fights?
You know, I really am thankful to my parents. Because in their own way, they didn't know what advocacy was, but they learned about it. You know, my mother, with the support of my father, you know, would step by step try to address what was happening. So I think that's definitely part of it. Other friends of mine, you know, we would, through the Camp Jeanette experience and others, talking about it. But I think something within me, and I was born in Philadelphia, but I grew up in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I do actually always talk about, if I wasn't born in Brooklyn, I probably wouldn't be the person I am today. I really do believe if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. And I think I learned really early on that I had to say something. When things were going on that I felt were wrong, I had to say something. I had to try to do something. And I've never been a person to want to do things by myself. I've always wanted to work with other people. And so, you know, for me, it's, we each play a different role. I think I'm a reasonably good strategist. I have a reasonably decent mouth to speak. But then I've got other friends who are great writers and do all these things. When we come together, we make a great team. And I think that's really why any movement moves forward. Because the people who are adversely affected by discrimination or whatever the issue may be, there's a bond between enough people to be able to really not only complain about the problem, but really look at solutions. And for me, it's recognizing that solutions don't happen overnight. Even when you make big gains, like with legislation, getting that legislation implemented and getting people, you know, to understand what is wrong with racism, what is wrong with anti-Semitism, what is wrong with ableism, what is wrong with all these different things. I think that, to me, it's a challenge, and I love working with people to try to make change.
Well, Judy, we are all of us, whatever categories we're in, out of, we're all the beneficiaries of the work that you've done, and it's been an honor to get to spend some time, socially distant as we have to be these days, to get to spend some time with you. I think Andy's going to come back in, and other people who are part of the Crowdcast will get to ask you questions. But for my own behalf, I just want to say thank you for what you've done. And I'm glad to be aware of it. And I've learned so much that hopefully will shape my behavior going forward.
Well, hopefully I'll get to see you in Philadelphia someday.
That I'll buy you a cheesesteak and a pretzel.
Okay. And you need to go to sleep because you have to get up so early for your next job. Thank you very much.
Tim, thank you so much. Appreciate you working. Appreciate you doing this. We'll see you soon in real life, I hope.
I'd love to.
Absolutely.
See your kids.
These days will end. And as always, Andy, it's been a joy.
Yeah.
I want to meet your children.
You say that, Judy. Be careful what you ask for.
No, I do.
But that would be the benefit for meeting you. All right. Enjoy the rest of the night, guys.
All right. Good night. Ma'am. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
So we have a ton of questions that have come in. Unfortunately, we're only going to be able to get to a handful of them. So I'm going to just jump right in here. The first question that people seem to want to ask is, how do you wrestle with the urge to advocate, educate, and change the world with just trying to live your life? Are there times you get exhausted by teachable moments?
My husband says the same thing all the time. He's like always complaining that I work too much, but I'm kind of driven. And sometimes I get very frustrated by how long it takes to make change and how people really, in many cases, still don't get it and therefore are not fighting with us, or not even fighting, but just don't understand why it's important for disabled people to have jobs and looking at what needs to be done in a business to ensure that someone who is able to do the job can get the accommodation that they may need. I'm Jewish, as I've said a number of times, and one thing the Jewish community has over the last, 20 years, but really more in the last 10 years, in part because of a foundation in Boston called the Ruderman Foundation. But the Ruderman Foundation has taken on a number of issues, one of which has really been to look within the Jewish community, the Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, on, and help to develop discussions that allow us within our communities to look at what we need to learn and what types of specific changes need to be going on within our institutions. That to me has been hard and painful in many ways because of some of the things I've said earlier. Sometimes it's difficult to tell someone that you sit next to when you go to services that you're really upset with some of their thinking, and to be able to be strategic about how you talk with people to get some of these issues move forward. So I try to be a change agent. And then sometimes I just check out, not for very long because I'm a complete phone addict.
What do you do when you check out? What is checking out for Judy Heumann?
Trying to spend more time with my husband. I like to go to movie theaters, so because I'm not good at just being idle or still when I'm here. I can go to a movie theater or to the, theater, ballet, whatever. And then you're there, so you have to focus on it. But otherwise, it's a problem for me.
Let's see, more questions. I found it very interesting that the Black Panthers helped you out during the crucial sit-in. Did the relationship endure afterward?
So one of the participants in the organizing of the 504 demonstrations was a member of the Black Panthers, and his assistant also. And Brad Lomax was his name. He unfortunately passed away. But the relationship continued. I would say they were supportive of the work that was going on within the disability community, and that was always important. I think that's one thing in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, Berkeley, Oakland, that the Center for Independent Living, which started in the early 70s, very much worked with all types of organizations, addressing issues of discrimination. And, you know, we got support from different groups when we needed them, and they could come to us and we would participate with them in different issues. So I think it was at that time a really important period of learning. And when we had the demonstrations in 1977, which lasted for about 28 days, there was daily support outside the building of people demonstrating. And it wasn't just the Great Panther, I'm sorry, the Black Panthers that supported us, but actually the Great Panthers was one of the groups that was involved. And Glide Memorial Church, their minister is a great activist and a real social justice person. Cesar Chavez and others supported our work, Eleanor Schneel from NOW, and other labor unions, and the International Machinists Union was very supportive when we took a group of 20 people and went to Washington. So we could not have done that by ourselves. No movements, in my view, can get what they need unless they can eventually get more people supporting what needs to happen. And so I think that's a principle that we've always worked on and continue to work on.
Here's another question. I understand that the camp was disbanded due to financial constraints. Were there no offers to buy the camp and keep its good work going? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Okay.
The answer was no, because otherwise it would have been sustained. And I think it's, you know, very interesting that, so Camp Jened, like many, there were many different camps around the United States for disabled children. And there were camps for disabled children because the regular camps didn't accept disabled children. And so that, you know, is another interesting point. You know, today there are all kinds of camps that kids go to study about technology or theater or this, that, or the other thing. My brothers went to a Jewish summer camp, and, you know, they went there to have fun. But also one of the things that they were learning there was about culture and Shabbos and songs and different things of that nature. When we went to the camps for disabled kids, none of that was considered like a part of the camp. People were not thinking about, well, this is a great opportunity for disabled kids to get together and start talking about how they feel as disabled people. What are the problems? What are their solutions? But that's what happened. And, you know, young people will say sometimes, what should we do? And, you know, one thing I always tell people is, don't wait to get permission from older people. What do you want to do? And yes, let's try to work together. But, you know, fight for what you believe in and move forward with it. And that's exactly what we did. And we didn't know a lot. I mean, we were looking at television and learning about the civil rights movement. We were learning about the marches. We were learning about the boycotts. We were learning about Rosa Parks. We were learning about Martin Luther King and so many other leaders. And what we were learning was that people believed in what they were doing and that they would fight as long as they had to, in a pacifist way and other ways, to be able to make changes that could positively affect communities. And those are very important things that we were learning and trying to emulate in our own way. And so, you know, I feel like we're very thankful for lessons that we've learned over the years, and now working more collaboratively with other movements, I think is really paying off, not just for us, but for others.
Throughout the course of the book, the support of your family plays an essential role. What advice would you give to young advocates with disabilities that lack the support of their families? And how do you overcome the fear in order to advocate?
First of all, I appreciate the fact that you acknowledge the issue of fear. And I don't think I've used that word tonight, but it's a completely appropriate word. And I believe that I did discuss it in some way with Tamala, because one can be afraid legitimately, depending on the situation that you're in. So I think it's very important to try to speak with other disabled people, to talk with them about situations or other people. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone with a disability, but someone who has experienced discrimination, to try to learn from them about what does it mean to be fearful and what do you need to do to try to overcome it. And I don't mean overcome the fear. I mean try to address the problem. And so, you know, for me, you know, an example, I was in New York. I was going to a restaurant, a Chinese restaurant, and I had a couple of other friends who had disabilities. We decided to go into this restaurant because it had enough space for more than one wheelchair. And when we got in there, we were told we couldn't stay. The manager, owner, whatever, said we had to leave. And that was one of these moments where, you know, first I was afraid, like, oh my God, this guy is saying that because we have disabilities, we can't be here. And then it was for me, well, am I going to leave? No way. So, you know, what am I going to do? I said, call the police. And he didn't call the police. So we stayed and we had dinner there. Now, one could argue we should have left, not give him our money. But on the other hand, the point was we wanted to prove a point. Was I afraid? I definitely was. Was it good that I was with other people and I could talk about it and we could talk about it together? Yes, absolutely. Continuing to talk about it today, because these incidents are still happening in spite of the fact that we have laws. Now, the point that you made about not even having a family that's supportive, you know, one, understanding why they're not, but on the other hand, you need to do what's right for you. And maybe, you know, I'm sure you've had discussions with them, but finding other people, maybe other adults who have children with disabilities, where they're being more supportive of their children and just learning from the other parents. But I think at the end of the day, it's finding other people that you can relate to and talk to. You're going to grow up and keep fighting for what you believe in and get support from people to help you move along the way and grow up to be the person you want to be.
Thank you. A number of people have written in to thank you, and they say they were moved by the film and they were moved by the book. So I want to acknowledge that there are a number of people with disabilities from various communities who are saying that and just thanking you from the bottom of their hearts. Let me move on to maybe one or two more questions. You sort of addressed this already, but I think this person is looking for a specific moment in some direction. This is from my son, a non-speaking adult who uses spelling on an alphabet board to communicate. You are an inspiration to me. When did you start to realize that if change was going to happen, you would have to be leading it? You would have to be leading it.
So I never see myself as a leader. I see myself as a leader with a group. You know, my mother was a leader. My mother worked with other mothers. One of the situations that was going on when I was growing up is, I finally got to go to school, as I said earlier, when I was 9 years old, but it was only in segregated classes in a school for non-disabled kids. We went to classes in the basement. Then my mother learned that because I was in a wheelchair, all students who used wheelchairs and couldn't walk up and down steps, we're going back on to home instruction for high school. So my mother organized with other mothers. So I'm sure she was afraid. She didn't know really what she was doing, except that she began to realize that working together, things could happen. And so for me, my model has, you know, typically been, even if I am doing something on the spot, like an issue with the airplane when they arrested me on an airplane for flying without someone else, I was there by myself, but I always would talk to people. So I really appreciate the fact that, you know, people are resonating to my story. But at the end of the day, what's really important is that people recognize that it does take a village to make change, that we all play a different role, and that it's really important for us to stay in touch with each other, to be supportive of each other, and to play the role, you know, that feels right for us at that moment. And people evolve and, you know, move forward and can take on more and more responsibilities if they choose.
Someone asks, this sort of circles back to the beginning of the book and the beginning of your talk this evening. Did you have any experiences with children your age before the age of 9? If not, how do you think that impacted you?
So I had polio when I was 18 months old. And obviously, I don't really remember anything about that. And then when I was about 4 years old, I went to a rehab center in Manhattan called Rusk Institute. And my father would bring me there on Monday mornings and pick me up Friday afternoons. So these, to deviate for a second, these were some of the areas where my parents became advocates. They wanted the kids to stay over the weekend. And my parents said, no, I wasn't going to stay over the weekend because nothing happened over the weekend and they wanted me to be home with the family. So my father would pick me up on Friday. I would get there early on Monday morning. Now, I remember at that time meeting other disabled people, particularly older people. So that had a little bit of an impact on me because that was really the only time that I was seeing other, you know, adults with disabilities who were productive. I mean, they were there for a reason. And some of the people at the hospital also worked there. So that might have been the first time that I ever saw disabled people working. But what was the question again? The last part.
Oh, the last part. Let me scroll back and see if I can get it. It went right out of my head right after I asked it.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
Oh, how did it influence me? So, So that period of time from when I was 5 years old till I was 9 years old was very, I was with my brothers and my neighbors, all of whom didn't have disabilities. I went to Hebrew school with my family because it was a small synagogue and we went every Sunday. And then I started going to another, you know, Hebrew school. And I was the only disabled kid. And there's an incident in the book where I talk about how when I was about 8 years old, I mean, remember at that time, there were no such things as motorized wheelchairs. All of the houses in the neighborhood that I lived in, except for ours with my parents, had a ramp built in the back. None of them were accessible. So I always had people pushing my wheelchair because I wasn't really strong enough to push my own. And if I went into neighbors' houses, I always had to be carried in and out. So the issue of independence was something that didn't really come into play later on because I was so dependent on the people. When I had polio, my parents built a bedroom and a bathroom on the back of the house, but it wasn't very big. And for example, I couldn't get to the closet. My mother had to go to the closet. There wasn't enough room. So even things like picking out my clothes, making choice, was difficult because she had two other kids. So, and she was my mother. So she knew what I wanted. She knew what she wanted me to wear. So I didn't have these basic experiences of go to the closet, take out what you want to wear. If your mother says, no, take it off, I don't like it, going back in and arguing about it. I didn't have that ability. And so I think, you know, one of the issues around camp and special classes, but camps in particular, was it was a time when we were able to begin to make more decisions on our own. You know, we would either go get our own clothes out or the counselors would ask, you know, what did you want to wear? They wouldn't pick things out for you. Little things like that are very important because, you know, kids learning how to make choice, how to make decisions, even how to argue with an adult and try to put a position forward. Those are all very important things. And one of the points that was discussed earlier about in Crypt Camp, for that when you watch it, you'll see that there is this group discussion. And part of the group discussion does focus on Nancy Rosenblum in particular, but others who don't have the level of independence. And it's not just the physical independence. It's also, you know, one of the reasons why I think it's important for parents that have disabled children to know adults with disabilities is to be able to talk about some of these issues, to be able to talk about, you know, what can be done so that you are not all encompassing in your child's life. How do you help ensure that your child is age appropriately being able to make decisions? Those are all very important things, because someone like myself and others, there is a degree of dependence that we have on other people, but choosing who we want to help us, when we want them to help us, how we want them to help us, those are all things that we need to be able to learn in some way how to deal with. And people need, you know, depending on the type of disability someone has, people need to be really conscious of how people may express dissatisfaction if they can't necessarily articulate it clearly. I mean, we know, for example, that violence, sexual violence, other forms of violence, are much higher in the disability community for many, many reasons. But it's a very important issue that A, we need to recognize this is a problem. B, we need to look at what is being done to address it. And one thing that frequently happens is we're not looking at the data, we're not looking at the causes. And institutions are another cause of violence against disabled individuals. And we read about it in the paper when things are really, really bad. So the daily things that go on, we don't even hear about.
And I would assume in the smaller homes where people are living on their own, that's not as much of an issue where they're in the congregate homes where there are just one or two people.
Yeah, especially if people are getting the support that they need, again, to make sure that if there are issues, they can discuss them.
Right. All right. We've got, there are so many questions and we just don't have time, unfortunately.
We'll do it again.
Yeah. Okay. We will see you here tomorrow night at 7:30. One last question. Somebody says, what would be different today if the history of disability rights were incorporated into the curriculum? And how do you think it would affect disabled and non-disabled children in the years going forward and into adulthood?
Well, I would say that it would be positive. We would have more knowledge. We would have a greater ability to have discussions and ask questions, not be afraid of asking questions as much, because I think people are afraid of asking questions. We would be able to really look at problems and look at solutions. We'd be able to learn from what has gone on in other movements. What are some of the common solutions? What are different solutions? For example, so let's talk about Rosa Parks. So Rosa Parks was arrested because she refused to go to the back of a bus. There was a boycott, and then the result of the boycott was people could sit any place in the bus they wanted. The equivalent in the area of disability really wasn't there. Because I couldn't get on the bus and other people with physical disabilities couldn't get on the buses because they weren't accessible. And people didn't want to make them accessible. Like, why would we make them accessible? People aren't going to use it. Why are we going to put, you know, ramps on streets? People aren't going to use it. Why do we need accessible bathrooms? People aren't going to use it. Why do we need Braille? Why do we need sign language? Why do we need captioning? Why do we need facilitated communication? Why do we need any of these things? When people don't understand both the benefit to us as disabled people, but also the universality, you know, I love to talk about, I live in Washington, D.C., and we have a metro system which has trains and buses. The way the trains became accessible in the 1970s when they were being constructed was a lawsuit against the city and the company that was contracted to make the trains. If that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have had accessible trains. Okay, fast forward into the 80s, 90s, the 2000s. When I go to an elevator for the Metro, it is very common that there are 1 to 5 baby carriages lined up at the elevator because they can't use the escalators. And people have no idea that the reason for the elevators is because disabled people fought for them. And we didn't fight for them just for ourselves. We fought for them for ourselves and because we clearly understand that the vast majority of things that we need benefit other people. So if people were really learning from when they were younger, if disabled and non-disabled children were going together to school, to camp, to early childhood, to high school, if in gender studies and Black studies and Latino studies, on and on, if disability was a part of the work that was going on there, that people learned about disability in the context of those other study areas, I don't think things would be perfect, but I think we would be much further ahead if people understood the link between disability and poverty because of lack of education or because people who are poor have higher rates of acquiring various forms of disabilities. So a robust, intentional inclusion and really looking at where we are and what we need to do, I think would really have a profound impact on our country and the world.
It sounds like you've left us with a lot of work to do, but you're quite a model for us to follow. Judy, thank you so much for all your time tonight and sharing your wisdom with us. And thank you for making the world a better place for everyone.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Be sure to follow us on Crowdcast and visit us online at freelibrary.org/author events to access our digital archives and updated event schedule, which seems to be changing every day. Judy, thanks again. Folks, keep reading and have a good night. Judy, thanks
again
so much. All right, take care. We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.